CliffCentral.com. Good morning. Okay, so we are live and I am back and we've got everything sorted. And Pumlani Majozi's in the studio. It's time for another Burning Platform. How are you, Pumlani?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
It's nice to see you. Always dressed so smartly, and I'm so sorry I'm not in studio for you this morning.
Yeah,
you,
man, I know. I
you deserve this. You deserve our full attention. You know,
Gareth. Do you see this?
Oh, he's so beautifully dressed, this guy, and he always knows exactly how to make us feel special.
Yes,
so listen,
first and
foremost, before we get into anything else, everybody already knows the Burning Platform. You've been a guest on here before, but you've got some exciting news. You've got a brand new book out, and I actually received it. I received
a PDF.
There it is. There it is.
To the listeners.
Lessons from Past Heroes.
Yes.
So tell us what this is, and tell us how you came about writing this book, and what the point of it is, because there's so many books. Everybody's talking about, you know, writing their book. And these days it's a lot easier than it's ever been, which is a very good thing. But why did you think this book was necessary? And tell us what it's all about.
Yeah. Thanks, Gareth. So the book is already out. It is available in stores across South Africa. You can get it there. You can also buy it from me as well if you are based here in Johannesburg. So I'm also my own seller as well. And then what I've done here, Gareth, is to... for those who have followed me for some time now, you will know that I have been very much vocal on the importance of, a freer society, right? A society that embraces a markets or a market-driven economy, a society that embraces personal responsibility, a society that embraces law and order. So, and what I've tried to do with this book is to basically consolidate those ideas. But now to explain to you how I do that in the book, let me just give you context as to how the book came about. So at one point years back, I was invited at a conference in Nairobi. We had a small conference there. And as we returned, flying over Africa back to Johannesburg, so I'm told to look at Pumi here, so not to...
He's looking away. You know. He's like so shy.
I'm a shy guy. Let me have my cup of coffee and then continue. Yeah, so Mr. Cliff. So and then... as we came back, there is this in-flight magazine on SAA, and I see this in-flight magazine, and I have a look inside it. I think it was the Sawubona magazine. When I see there, at the time, they were celebrating, the ANC government was celebrating Oliver Tambo. I think he had turned 100 years, and they were remembering him. And a section there was about the life of Oliver Tambo. When I read in that magazine the achievements of this guy, personally, right, educationally, what it is he pursued to be a better person, right, what he did to advance himself in order to succeed in an environment that was very hard to, to achieve things at the time, the context of South Africa. And I was quite moved by his story, you know, his personal achievement. And I was like, you know, I think I should put together a book where I basically look at pick up a few personalities who did amazing things at a time when, the context or South Africa setting was very difficult to navigate, especially for the majority black people. And I said, let me pick up these names and just do some profiles of these people or do some portraits of these people, highlight their achievement and say to South Africans, look, if there were people who could do these things, at a time where things were very difficult for them, then what should we be complaining about now, right? We live in a democratic society. Our society is much open now. Everybody has a right to pursue their interests, and also we have a right as a people to hold our leaders to account. And that's what motivated me to write this book. And I said, you know what? Let me explore these people and say to South Africans, if these guys could do it, what are we complaining about now? Let's fix our country. Let's focus on a few specific things that I mention in the book, that I explore in detail, and say, let's fix these things in order to make South Africa one of the best competitive, wealthier societies.
And for you, G- Gareth, 2023.
I thought you said make South Africa great again is basically the summary here. And I love the fact that there are two reasons that you, from what I heard you say here. Number one, there are loads of black leaders who are underrepresented in the history classes and in social media and online and in what they like to boast about these days in the ANC in particular. Those people deserve some attention. That's number one. And number two, these people were doing what they were doing at a time where it was extremely difficult to get ahead, to make things happen for black people in business, for black people in politics, for black people in society to advance themselves. And yet they succeeded over all those obstacles, which is a tremendous story of human resilience, if nothing else. And I love that. I think it's such a great idea. Sorry, Pums, I interrupted you.
No, so, you know, one of the chapters, and I'm just flipping through the book now, is really about the socioeconomic issues that were important to the founders of the ANC.
Yes.
Do you want to expand a little bit on that? And also what it looks like today? What do you think are the socioeconomic issues that are most important to worry about?
Yeah, in this day and age. About. Look, at the time, we need to understand the context of South Africa at the time, right? And this is early 1900s, right? When the ANC was formed at the time, the mission or the goal with the formation of the ANC was for people of different tribes, black people, to come together. And remember, these were guys who were from central South Africa. These were guys from the east side, and some of the guys were from the colony. When you look at the cover of the book, you've got those personalities you see. That was the black elite. You know, on the far left was Thomas Mapikela, right, who was from that side of Bloemfontein. And then you have Walter Rupusana, who was from the side of the Cape Colony. And then we have John Langalibalele Dube, we have Saul Msane, as well as Saul Plaatje as well. And this, when you look at these people, they came from different regions across the country to come together and basically to say, look, we live in a society where black people, we are not being recognized. Remember, this was just 2 or 3 years later when the Union of South Africa was formed. The Union of South Africa was a state that didn't recognize black people, right? It was a formation of a state between, it was basically a white state, right? And there were laws, including the Land Act that was passed at the time, which basically marginalized and ostracized black people. And these guys came together to say, look, we need to, and it was the first time, by the way, that people of these different regions, black people, could come together and try to form something national. And at the time, which is what I highlight in the book, the main issues were around how do we get to be recognized in the country, right? How do we get to be participants in the shaping of the governance of our country? That was the main critical thing at the time. And people, and I do highlight that you know, at the time, even this was just a general trend around the world. Even when you look at the government spending rates at the time, this was where basically the ideas of Adam Smith, whom I do cite in the book, were much more, recognized and embraced, that the economy must be largely driven by, you know, by the market, right? When you look at even the government spending, even in developed countries at the time, it was something around plus minus 10% of GDP at the time. And I do cite some academic studies there. So there was not much that this, they were not expecting that government should be the helper or the nanny or to take care of them. All what mattered to them the most was to be, to have a voice in their society, for them to shape the governance of the country and to have their own land. Of which in many instances, of course, they had been marginalized and couldn't have full control of that. So those were the issues at the time.
They were dispossessed.
They were dispossessed. That's what I'm saying, yes. Because of the Union of South Africa, of the laws it pursued after that, after we had the Union. These guys were not, Gareth, the folks who were expecting much from government, as we see today. The idea was that we want to be recognized.
They weren't even expecting much from society because they were largely outsiders. And really, they weren't getting any support from white business or from social institutions or any of that. There wasn't anything like that for black people in the 1900s in South Africa.
Yes, there wasn't. And these people, you know, what I love about them the most was to go beyond and to look at where can they get opportunities beyond South Africa. These guys I'm talking about.
Right.
These guys, Garrett, they were educated overseas. Some of them lectured in the West, in USA, being lecturers there. They were educated in the UK. And then they would come back here and shape South Africa's or the black intellectualism at the time and start newspapers, be writers and so on. These people were world-traveled, so they understood the world, which is just amazing when you think of that. At that time, we have people who were doing such things, and we focus.
And what do we have? What do we have now? Now we have Fikile Mbalula.
So the second part of my question, though, was what about today? You know, what if those were the issues then, how has it changed to now? And then also, what are the most important, in your mind, what are the most critical socioeconomic factors that we should be interested in and looking for ways to solve?
Well, the socioeconomic issues we face right now, look, we all now can shape the destiny of our country, no doubt. Anyone who says that, I would never buy a person who still plays the victimhood card, which is what the subtitle of the book is. We can shape our governance. We can pursue our dreams within a place that is much better than what it was back then. If you want to pursue, you have business ambitions, you can pursue that in the country. There is even various fundings that you can get through. So there is much even in education as well. I look at the achievements of that we've, in fact, the achievements and the failures when it comes to our education system in the post 1994 setting. But your question is, you know, what are the issues right now? The issues right now are mainly having to do with how to deal with them very much shocking unemployment rates that we see in the country. The issues right now is how do we deal with the very fundamental problem of high crime rates, right? Those are the issues. The issues are about how do you deal with a state or a country where we really have serious issues around the family breakdown, right? The breakdown of families. We come from broken homes in this country, and that has a serious impact on our society. The issues are about a state that has become corrupt, right? How do you deal with the issues of corruption? The issues are about how do you deal with the issues of, we look at our borders as well. We need security there. How do we deal with those issues? So those are the fundamental problems right now that we face. And as I lay out in the book, that the economic state of our country requires that shift in thinking, right? Which I don't think we are seeing in the ANC so far, especially after Jacob Zuma. Because I do make the case that over the past, in fact, since the first two administrations in our democracy, they did better on the economy, right? And then the downhill or things going south began from the Zuma administration. And we haven't really been, we haven't reversed that decline. So those, I would say, are the issues that we have to deal with now. It's not the issues of, you know, I'm not free. No, you are free now to do many things, right? In large part, in contrast to the
what
people
about, I mean,
who live in
let
them.
Me play devil's advocate.
Yeah, you are a devil anyway. So,
so what the EFF say is, no, we haven't. The struggle is not over. We have not got economic equality, as if that's something noble to pursue, is equality. But is that a fool's errand, or are they just playing to the cheap seats, or are they playing to people's jealousy, bitterness, and resentment over being left out, and very often left out on purpose by the state and the institutions of state and the economy at large? And Pumi and I often talk about equality as being a thing, because just this morning we were talking about how much the Woolworths CEO earns, and shame, He's on a low salary compared to CEOs. But the difference between those very wealthy people and those very poor people becomes an obsession for some, and it becomes a great political football to throw around for people on the left, like the EFF. Don't you agree?
Well, you know, it's very important, Gareth, to think about what we mean by equality, right? And the equality that is sustainable and that can be achieved is the equality before the law. And the equality of opportunity, which I think is very important. And I have, over the years, argued that the government must focus more, concentrate more on trying to create opportunities for everybody in the country. And that's where equality, that's where we should focus when it comes to equality. The idea that you can have people who have different experiences, different skills, different educational levels, different talents, because talents are not even the same, earning the same or making the same wealth. That's not really possible. And if you try and do that, you are really going to cost the economy. You'll end up sort of ostracizing, not creating an environment where people can have an opportunity to strive for their goals and their ambitions. So my point is that our focus must be more in creating the equality of opportunity than the equality of wealth, because I mean, if you want to achieve equality of wealth, the moment you focus there, the obsession will be, well, how do you take from one CEO or one person who earns X and give it to another person who ends, who gets a different pay. And that to me is such redistribution is not an efficient way of addressing things. What you need to do, though, which is very important, is to upskill your people, that they have an opportunity and that they have a chance to pursue their dreams and their ambitions. And the way to do that is to invest, make sure that you invest in their educational, attainment, their skills. You invest in entrepreneurship as well, along with the private sector. You can do those things. So that's where you want to create skills, to increase and improve people's productivity, so that they can have an opportunity also to pursue their dreams, right, and hopefully make more incomes as well to catch up to other people.
Gareth, you wanted to say something?
No, I think that sounds like very obvious and reasonable to me. But for some reason, the inequality mantra seems very popular politically. And that's what I'm interested in. Why is it that so many, especially young people, are left out of the economy and are warm? They are warm receivers of the message that our biggest problem is that capitalism is a parasitic system which preys on the weak and the poor. I mean, you just got back from a conference in London, right? Tell us about that and what came up there, because it wasn't all just political. There must have been some discussions around economy, because we know that people in the world are suddenly starting, especially young people, to find themselves willing to listen to messages which we thought had died out and been defeated after the Cold War.
The ARC conference, the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship conference, is a brainchild of Dr. Jordan Peterson, right, who is a famous psychologist.
Sure.
He has put this forum together, Gareth. He took people from around the world whom he, at least in his view, and the views of the people he work with, right center and right people, right? And by right and right center, I'm talking about people who believe in liberty, individual freedom, freer markets. Those are the people who, in personal responsibility, those are the people that Professor Jordan Peterson gathered. So they spotted many of them around the world. And then I was one of those people. I was invited to come through to attend the conference. And the objective of the conference is to basically remind you know, well, some of the guys that they were saying, well, we are defending Western values that are being attacked by wokeism, you know, and so on. But I was thinking when I was sitting there, look, I'm a dude from a rural KwaZulu-Natal where I come from, yet I could affiliate to the conversation there.
Yeah.
And you know why, Gareth? Because the values that were being discussed were universal values. We all want to be individual, freedom, human beings, right? All come from families. And that was some of the topics there were about families. How do we make families stronger? How do you mm-hmm. ensure that we have, you know, free speech, which is in many ways is being attacked? How do we fight back against the cancel culture that you, Gareth, yourself, some people have attempted to cancel you? So how do you fight back and push back against those disturbing trends in democracies? And Jordan is trying to do that. And his message is this: look, we have an opportunity to fix our countries. Let's not be convinced that the fundamentals of markets and capitalism, they are evil. It's an evil system. No, it's a system that is better than others, right? Because it allows for individual freedom. It allows for faster growth in economies. And that was what that conference was about. And when you ask about why the race thing amongst the politicians, well, for politicians, it's easy for them to pursue topics that will divide us, right? To pursue topics that will sort of paint or portray our society as where a white man is doing well at the expense of a black person in this day and age, right? So to play those racial divisions, it's a way of saying, look, if you vote for me, what I will do is that I'm going to somehow make sure that we get that wealth of that another person and somehow transfer it to you. And that is very much misleading our people, our young people, and I think even the academic institutions, this demon is them, and we need to push back against it in democracy.
Okay. Well, Phumlani, though,
all right.
You know, and I know you spoke about Adam Smith, and because I see on your social media, he's one of the people that you quite hold in esteem, right? And he was, besides just being an economist, he was also a philosopher. And one of the things he very famously said, you know, was that no society can surely be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable. So it's not, I mean, when you look at it today in South Africa, which is why some of these concepts may take hold, is when you live in a society where half the people in the society are living on less than 20 rand a day. And then you have a CEO on the other side that is earning 266,000 rand a day. And the price of milk is 27 rand.
Mm.
So this is where we are today.
Yes.
And considering that, you know, the earliest, I mean, when he wrote Wealth of Nations, one of the things about it was almost considered heresy at the time, you know.
Yeah.
And part of it was really about not just a society that is wealthy, but also a society that is healthy, a society where we have to find a balance between these two things. You cannot just allow rampant capitalism. And where you have unhappy, poor and miserable people, even the people with money are living in a precarious environment. You know, so what does that shift require? Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, you said what was the price of the milk? 27 rand.
Mm.
You said that right.
Mm.
Okay, so the price is 27 rand. What has been pushing up over the past year or two? What has been pushing up inflation? What has been pushing up prices? It's been the load shedding issue as a contributor. Farmers have been facing a serious issue around the load shedding problems. Mm-hmm. Who brought the load shedding problems? Isn't it the state? The failure of the state? You look at the Transnet matter, Pumi. The Transnet matter, where we have serious logistical backlogs, right? Mm-hmm. Where we have all these places where there are goods coming out and coming into South Africa, there are serious delays and supply problems. Who is responsible for Transnet at the moment? Isn't it government? Right. My point to you
government is that government has always been responsible for Transnet.
But my point to you. My point to you is this. Where you see some serious things like inflation skyrocketing and going high, where in fact, even when you look at, by the way, even the price of petrol, even the price of petrol, you'll find out that plus minus about 40% of it is taxes, right? Again, that pushes up the price. Yeah. My point to you, Pumi, is this. Where you see that there is some economic problems, including inflation. My argument to you is that the government has been responsible for that, because we wouldn't have prices going high if load shedding was fixed, right? We wouldn't have prices going high if we didn't have Transnet issues. All these are governmental problems.
So what are you asking for? What are you asking for? Because you started out saying that, you know, government needs to ensure that opportunity that young people are brought into the economy, and now you are saying government is the problem. So what is it that you want?
Hang on. Your question for me was like, unfettered capitalism does evil, but then Pumlani's pointing out that in our context, it isn't capitalism.
The evil of price. The evil of price is skyrocketing.
It's statism above all. That's led to these problems.
The question, though, is where Pumlane starts by saying that government needs to do more. That's where Pumlane started, is that government needs to, and it's not just unfettered capitalism.
All I'm saying is that
where we sit in South Africa today, where half the people in this country are living and languishing in poverty and misery.
Yeah, thanks to government as a contributor to poverty is my point.
But where we sit today, so what do you want? Do you want government do something, or do you want government to do nothing?
Of course I want government to do something.
Mm.
And remember what I said to you earlier. I spoke about that we must be equal before the law and have equal opportunity, right? We cannot equalize wealth or incomes. That's what I'm against, all this redistribution. What's the idea that, a CEO earns seven times than Pumlani? That's why it's going to get us to a point where we are failing to address the real issues that contribute to those wealth gaps, right? My point to you is this. The government must focus more on upskilling, right, our people, and driving entrepreneurship. That should be the main focus. And creating the frameworks of a situation where things like load sheddings, they are fixed. Things like dealing with the issue of, the Transnet matters, that is being fixed. So my point to you is that create an environment. I'm not saying government shouldn't do anything. I'm saying that government has been doing things the wrong way, and in many instances, failing or destroying some of the elements that will help us to have a productive economy.
So that is my point.
Yeah.
So what I'm asking is, what does the solution look like for you? What are these changes that you are looking for? What are these policy changes that you are looking for?
Oh, that one is a simple one, right? Okay, firstly, you need to deal with the issue of load shedding. That's an obvious one, right, that everybody knows. Now, you don't deal with the issue of load shedding which is what we've done over the past decades, right? From the apartheid era, not only from our democratic era, you can't have one company supplying power. You've got to have more companies supplying electricity or supplying power. You have to deal with the issue of educational skills. In the book, I highlight for me the problems of our education, right? And I cite some reports there that shows that countries like Tanzania, Gareth, countries like poorer countries by GDP per capita, poorer countries by infrastructure, they are doing better than us when it comes to education. So we do not have that competitive education that we need to address. You have to deal with the issues of law and order, right? Just last week, 2 weeks back, the World Bank said, look, South Africa's the levels of crime are costing South Africa about 10% of its GDP a year. So think about that. Again, that's an issue that government needs to address around the law and order in the country. Get rid of the regulations that make it difficult for people to find employment. I'm not a fan of the national minimum wage. I'm not a fan. I just think it's there for dogmatic reasons, right? It's not there for the purposes of creating a thriving labor market. Right. And we have to address the issues of the labor costs that are quite troubling when you look at even by the sub-Saharan, regional comparisons, that our labor costs are quite higher. Now, let me ask you one thing, Pumi. Why do you think companies like Tesla, like Apple, They don't come to create factories in South Africa. They go elsewhere, in East Asia and so on. When we have unemployment rates of plus 65% for young people, they don't come here, right? That's because we've made our market. Even Elon Musk is struggling to operate in this country, right? So those are the things we have to fix. You start with the basic. You know, so I mean, these are the things that I don't want to give away too much, and then people end up not buying the book and said, we listen to Phumlani anyway. But that's the point I'm making here, that much of our problems that we have to address, they come from, you know, from incompetence of our leaders. And that's, you can't blame capitalism.
Hang on. I also think that there's this idea that you can't walk and chew gum at the same time. Like you need government to get the things that government is responsible for working. Is that more or less what you're saying, Phumlani? As in, like, since we have state-owned enterprises, it's not an ideal situation, but we have them. So we might as well make them work. And if they work, they can help build the infrastructure and supply the resources that we need in the economy. And we're not going to just overnight disband and disestablish them. We have to do these things carefully and slowly. And the idea of Chesterton's fences, if you don't know what the fence is for, don't break it down. But there's also this important question of, and I think the two aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. There's this idea that the more government stays out of private business, the better. Generally, if I have something to trade with Pumi, I don't need a third party in terms of government coming in trying to get their share of it in tax, trying to get their share of it in terms of making laws that affect Pumi and my trade. There's no need for that. It's getting in the way and it's unnecessary and it's corporate statism.
I keep losing Gareth.
Are we okay, Ryan?
It's going on and off.
Are you,
is it?
Did you hear any of that now?
Can you hear any
of Pumi, did you hear me?
Yeah, I did. I'll tell him about what you said.
I can't hear Gareth.
Okay, Ryan's coming to help us out.
Oh, okay. Obviously, it's Pumi's head, Phumlani's headphones.
Phumlani's headphones. You know,
I suspect it's my headphones.
But okay, so you know, Gareth is asking about the between two people, right? That we need less interference when there is trade in place.
Yeah.
And Gareth, I mean, I think you and I have over many episodes of this spoken a lot about this, but I do want to ask you, you know, because the book is called Lessons from Past Heroes, and one of the things, funny, we were talking about this at the office the other day, that these guys that are on the cover of your book got on their horse and carriages and went their first meeting, Mangaung or whatever it is, you know, drove their horse and carriages for days on end to come together and put their minds to the problem and how they believe the problem needs to be solved. And so today, and it's not government, they were not in government at the time, you know?
Yeah.
So
they were not here.
For you, the individual lessons for individuals within South Africa is what?
You know, that's a great question, because I was speaking at a conference sometime this year. I think it was around July. And then I ended up, when I was doing my presentation, saying, look, there are great lessons we can get from AfriForum, right? Because these guys, yes, they represent Africana interests, but they have, you know, built a college, Soltech, their college, through the funding that their members put together. It was ahead of schedule, right? It's use coming into operation. And I think also it was under budget or something along those lines. Don't quote me on that. So there are great lessons here. These are people who have said, look, the government is failing us, Pumi, you know, we must do something as a society to try and better our communities. And the question is, how can we, the culture we saw there with what was done by AfriForum? Now, when you mention AfriForum, people get emotional. One guy after the conference came and said to me, you just mentioned racist people. That's not good for you. You know, I just said, look, I mean, we can learn something from, they are South Africans. We can learn something from them. Now that tells you that spirit. And you said that these people, they were not representatives or somehow involved in government. These were private individuals, who mobilized, right, come together. Now, my point is that there are even current examples, like I've just given to you now, where communities come together and try to address problems that in many instances our state is failing. And that's a positive that people can come together like that. So my point is that it's the initiative has to be taken by us to come together where we can do things together and in our communities to make a difference. This idea that we have to wait for, which is what the whole book is about. It's a counter to this thing of government must be the nanny in South Africa. That government must be the helper, that everything begins with them. We want to be a society where the government must play its role in the sense that it creates the landscape and the frameworks where we as people can pursue, you know, our interests and come together as a people to better our communities. And
so
places like
AfriForum
are quite a good example.
So what would you say, the median age in South Africa is 27. So what would you say to a 22-year-old in Mutu who today is looking at the South Africa that she lives in? What do you think she can do today, tomorrow, every day for the next month, for instance, that changes her situation? And what is the lesson from these guys who were middle-aged, educated, moneyed?
Now, there's something, Pume, I highlight in the book. And this is this. Here's a fact that can't be disputed. Even before 1994, there was education that was there, right, for black people. Yes, it was second class, third class education, because of segregationist sort of policies, but there was education. And there were these classes that we talk about today, where you have the richer, where you have the middle people, there was, and also we have the poor. Those classes were there still, even back at the time. My point to you is this. My point to you is that the people I mentioned there, they made use of what was available in front of them to be better than those who chose not to, or those who decided not to, you know, to work harder and pursue education. So the guys who pursued what was available in front of them, they came off better off. That's just the reality. So my point here is that for young people in South Africa, in the book, I propose about four or five things that they need to think about and focus on. First of all, make sure that you pursue education intensely, right? And now it doesn't matter whether you live in a township, whether it's in a rural. I'm from a rural. I'm rural KZN. There were schools there. We went to schools. Wherever, you have to pursue what is given in front of you. I speak about I'm talking to an individual young person here. You have to ensure that you take personal responsibility on many things. Right. Avoid getting involved in things that will sort of make you lose track on your education. Right. And that, by the way, also takes, and this will be directed also to the issue of families, right?
What do you mean by that? Like getting what? Into campus activities that are not academic? What do you mean?
No, Gareth. We should look at the teenage pregnancy rates. They are quite troubling in South Africa.
Ah,
so
okay.
Things like that.
Okay, yeah.
So we look at the consumption of drugs.
So what are you saying, Yegaba fan?
No, I'm not speaking to girls. You are repositioning it now.
I asked you to say to a girl. That's what I said to you. What would you say?
No, you said to a young person.
No, I said 22-year-old.
No, she did say a girl.
Yeah. She did say a girl. Did you? Oh, okay, all right. Yeah. So that's one of the advice that you talk of, because that's part of personal responsibility, right? So rather focus on things that will improve your well-being. And I also highlight in the book, I tell my personal story that one of the unfortunate things about my upbringing was that my parents, even though they had values, very good values, traditional values, they were not educated, right? So what I did was that, in fact, this was a trend that where kids came from poorer families that were not educated. The high school would be the place where they learn many things, right? Including learning some things that they couldn't get at home, right? They hang around with teachers who are educated. And one of the stories I told there is that when I used my teachers as a way of for me to make progress, right? Whenever I was dealing with applications and so on, I would ask my teachers to help me to push for that. Because I was driven, I wanted to be something, right? So that's one thing, that use the school, that you the environment where you can get help and exploit that to make a difference to your life. And most importantly also, try and be a person who understands and wants to hold people to account, right? And by the way, I'm not talking about just in communities in terms of whether being led by counselors or, but also in schools as well. Be able to know as a student as to what is your right and how you can and how when the system is being abused, you are able to speak up, right? I need education as a young person. I cannot have a situation where teachers are shutting down the schools because of unionism and things like that. So those are basic things that for a person, it begins with such basic things to be a responsible person who's not distracted by the things that will destroy their education. More importantly for a young person, focus on improving yourself and look for, you know, take some. I mentioned how I got my first job, right? My first job when I was in high school was around, you know, I was doing some garden, right? I was a garden boy, if you can call me that. Mm. You know, but I worked and earned income, right? And I remember I mentioned this in the book, the first time I negotiated my salary, right? And that will tell you, Gareth, the powers of the free market that I advocate for right there on the spot, yeah. with that example. So, but I mean, you've got to find something to do to keep you busy as a young person. Now, that's a message to a young person I would give, because at the end of the day, much of the politics, the policy things, they're not controlled by young people. All a young person can do largely is to concentrate and exploit the opportunities that are around them in order to succeed. And it's not only a girl issue, even boys as well. That's how they should be thinking about, when it comes to improving their lives.
All right, Pums.
Yeah, boy.
I know that you asked that question for a good reason. I know that you're thinking, like, what is the advice we can actually give people on the ground? Mm-hmm. But a lot of this stuff is up for grabs in this election, right? So we've got an election next year. You've written this book about lessons we can learn from the past heroes. What are the qualities of leadership? Because this is often a conversation that we have on this show. It's a conversation that happens with friends of mine. We're like, well, the leaders, there's such a huge problem with quality of leadership in the world. There aren't people stepping up, standing up for things, saying what they think, rallying people to a good cause. What do you think the leaders of the past had, or we imagine they had, that the leaders of the present do not?
That's a very interesting question. Very interesting question. Then, when we look at today's leadership, and this is what frustrates me a lot, I have noticed that there are many, okay, it's a democracy. Look, it's fine, it's a democracy. But there are many new parties emerging. Every now and then there's now a new party. Every now and then there's now a new party coming through.
Everyone thinks they're a leader, but what are they meant to have that the guys in the past
and have? they want to be presidents. And the guys in the past, they were more driven by addressing the issues of the time that they faced. Right. And those guys, they had perseverance, they had a vision, and most importantly, they had greater interests they were driven more by people's interest at the time, the interest of the people who were marginalized. And then today, where we see leaders wanting to be leaders, largely because, at least it seems to me, they just want to be presidents. Everyone thinks, no one wants to. I have argued in some instances, Gareth, that there are people who could come together and as there are different political parties, they can come together, choose one person, and then they lead and try to counter the ANC. But they don't want to do that.
Pumlana,
they want to be different.
On one hand, you are a big proponent of the free market that says everybody should be allowed to start their own business because it increases competition. But on the other hand, you are saying the politicians or the individuals who feel that what they are looking for is not being offered by what is out there. And therefore, they are starting their own thing and they are proposing those values and they are proposing those ideas. It's counterintuitive to say in politics there should be 1, 2, 3 parties, but in business there should be 20 options for people. I think that we do need as many individuals putting out ideas out there for how this country should be, can be, and creating opportunity to have a very robust debate, firstly, but also a very heated contestation for the voter, because that's how you get more people to come out. That's how you get more people
okay,
to come
let's
out.
Get,
let them contest their ideas.
Pumi, let's not be theoretical at the moment.
It's not theoretical.
We have an election coming up next year.
Yes. Yeah.
We know what the problem is in South Africa, at least from my perspective, and that we have had a government led by the ANC that has failed its people, right? Now, do you seriously believe? Now, you are saying that, well, I'm arguing that in business there should be multiple options, but in politics there should... Of course, I can argue that was a political setting. If you want to achieve a stable South Africa where politicians are held to account, I can argue for that. I can encourage... I'm not forcing people. I can encourage that. Let's rather come together, have one force that counters the ANC. Do you seriously believe that having all these multiple, everyone coming to be a president is going to defeat the ANC next year? It's not going to do
that. That's
not
what they're saying.
And the goal must be, but I'm telling you what the goal must be, right? The goal must be, how do we, especially I'm talking about the political side now, the goal must be, how do we remove the ANC out of power? How do we defeat the ANC next year? And that is why there is this multi-party coalition arrangement that has taken place.
Do you think this multi-party coalition is a good vehicle for achieving the goal of getting the ANC out?
But Garrett,
or do you think that it's going to fail like COPE? Like you could argue that Herman Mashaba in Johannesburg was a failure. You can argue that Ngwazam Sibi in Northern KwaZulu-Natal was a failure. And these are all the rats and mice people. Pumi's saying, no, there must be a contestation of ideas, which is never a bad thing. I mean, I think we all agree that's good. But you're saying practically, am I right? Practically, we already know what the options are.
Look, Gareth, we need the ANC government to be out of power next year. So your question, what do I think about the multi-party? I think it's a good initiative. It supports my point, okay, the argument I'm making, that rather consolidate and try to fight for the defeat of the ANC. If your values are, they can't be 100% aligned, but they are largely aligned, or to an extent they are aligned, which is what we are seeing with the multi-party coalition. So it's a good initiative that they are coming together with an aim to remove the ANC out of power at this point. Because, Gareth, all these different smaller parties, as you say, they are going to collapse, not going to help. Everyone wants to be president. It's not helpful. Yeah. Rather come together, campaign and offer something, say we are going to, the goal must be to, just as the goal was to remove the apartheid system by the black people of the time, these black leaders I talk about, the main goal now from the multi-party coalition must be to remove the ANC.
You know, and this is where the contestation of ideas is about, right? Today, when we look back, we think that the goal was to remove an apartheid system, but actually it was about having a political autonomy. What that meant was that you have to remove apartheid. Mm-hmm. But the idea was that every man should be free
and a vote. Yeah.
To have their own political destiny.
Which is one idea that we're fighting for.
That is the idea. But
yes.
And differently to what you are saying, the idea to remove the ANC, that is not an idea. That is a consequence. Is an idea that says our constitution promises to free the potential of everyone. And what that requires is it requires a market that will allow everybody to operate. The consequence is remove the ANC. The idea is change the way that business is done. Now you have got people saying, oh, okay, these people are talking about what is important to me. These people are talking about opportunity for me to work as a young person. These people are talking about an opportunity to build my business as a business person. Mm-hmm. Now you want to go to the poll. But when you are just saying remove the ANC, what people are asking is they are asking, and then what? What will you do differently
from the
ANC?
What do you mean, and then what?
If you are not having a conversation that says, this is what I will do differently, then people don't show up to vote.
But
this is not theoretical. This is what we see. More people don't show up to vote because they're going, and then what?
Okay. So why are you railing against that, Pumlani? What's the problem with what Pumi
is
saying?
Pumi, she's asking the question, and then what if we defeat the ANC? And then the new people come in to take power. Those people can be in the form of a coalition. That would be fine. But we need a situation where the ANC is out of power. What comes up after that is some governance where the ANC is not not governing. That's what I'm saying. And you know, we need to get practical here, guys. Let's not really get to what we want to achieve right now, which is what I say in the book. We have an election next year, and we've seen what the problem is in the country, and that is the ANC's governance, and the goal must be to defeat the ANC. And I'm saying my recommendation is that I do support the multi-party sort of coalition that has been put in place, because it's people who largely sort of have the same values. They are not exactly the same. Of course, they do disagree on many things, but they largely have. And for them to come together and to say, we want to combine and defeat the ANC. But do you seriously think that Freedom Front Plus can defeat the ANC or any smaller parties, even Action SA? Guys, it's not going to happen. Let's be realistic and stop your rising. We want change next year, and the change can only come if guys like the multi-party coalition stand together for the benefit of South Africa.
Okay, so Pumlani, you want to be practical. Let's get practical.
Get real.
Let's cut to the chase here. We've got like 6 minutes left of the show. You've just written this book. We talked about leadership, and there's some interesting questions here. I mean, this is just to comment on this. Leanne says, morals, values, and integrity is what is lacking when it comes to
leadership.
And
Leanne is right. That's a good point, yeah.
So leadership, leaders need to say what they think and do what they say. Who would you vote for in the upcoming elections? Because, you know, in this country, we obfuscate, and white people are too embarrassed to say that they'll vote for the DA, because everybody goes, oh, well, I think that because it's a white person, they're going to vote for the DA. Black people are always accused. Well, secretly, they love the ANC. They just pretend, especially if they're the clever blacks, you know, the ones who talk on radio stations and that kind of thing. Well, they say they hate the ANC, but people suspect that they vote for them anyway. And then people like Pumi, who are trying to understand what everybody else wants to do, is accused of being DA one day, EFF the next day, ANC the next day. We've got to say what we really think. Who would you vote for? Who's the best option on the menu
because
at the
you
moment?
Know who's not on the ballot. You know who's not on the ballot.
Who?
A multi-party coalition.
Correct. So who would you vote for?
Oh, you know, you are putting me in a very difficult spot here. But what I don't want to give the actual name of who I would vote for. But I argue in the book that, and there's one section where I counter the narrative that we don't have an alternative to the ANC. And I think that's very much misleading. We do have many parties in the country that we could vote for. DA has experience in governance. IFP has also governed before. Look, you have to give other people a chance to govern the country. I would definitely not vote for the far leftist EFF because of its ideas that are very much counter to the values I stand for. So definitely it's a no there. But I will definitely look into within this multi-party coalition, because I think it's a good initiative and it has my support. I'm not ashamed of saying
that. But as Pumi says, that you can't vote for the multi-party coalition, but you're saying you're going to vote for one of the parties.
That's
in
my
that
point.
Coalition.
Indirectly, that's what I'm saying. I will vote for one of those parties because their values, they are sort of largely to an extent aligned to mine.
So Stink Mina here in the comments is saying, and I hate when people just jump to these conclusions, like everyone is being paid by political parties. The political parties have no money, for starters. They really don't. They don't have the kind of money that American political parties have where they can deploy hundreds of ambassadors into civil society. Mm, we all know Pumlani is a DA stogie, says Stink Mina. I mean, that's That's not true, is it?
What?
That you're some kind of agent for the DA.
No, that's nonsense. It's just I have said that the DA governs better than the ANC, which is what the data shows.
And well, I've said that we do have an
alternative.
That's true.
Yeah, that's true. We do have alternatives.
I'm sitting here in a province, and I visit here a couple of times a year, and I can see there is growth and development, and there's good administration here. The roads are fixed. Things are happening. That's purely a question. It's not about politics or emotion. That's purely about, like, service delivery.
It's governance.
That's
it's
all.
Proper governance.
Governance.
Oh, well, I wouldn't call it proper, but it's better governance, which is what we're arguing.
So let me ask this quickly, because Kaza says, I've only ever voted ANC, but not this time. This is a refrain we hear from many people. What do you comment to that?
Is he saying that he's only voted for the ANC and this time?
Before, and this time not voting for the ANC.
Ah, okay. No, that's a positive, but I would advise that don't vote for the EFF, which is what I've been saying for a long time. Because the EFF the country would be more destroyed, far worse than how the ANC has mismanaged it. That has been my argument. Because of their leftist sort of pro-Chavez ideology and ideas.
Do you think that that's how many people are feeling? That they're not going to vote ANC, so they'll vote EFF?
Of course, there are many people who think that. Why would you think that the EFF has doubled its support since its founding? Was it around 2014 where they founded or so? That's because we have had people who have, you know, it's happening. But my point is that, look, Gareth, these are my opinions and my advices, right? And I'm not forcing anyone to be, it's just what I think should be how we should handle the situation. I'm saying, don't vote for EFF.
And I'm not trying to put you in an awkward position. I mean, I've got to thank you because so many times on social media, and you are brave, my friend, you are brave if nothing else. One of the qualities of leadership and some of those people that you write about in your book is courage. And there are so few people in politics and in conversation on social media who actually have the courage of their convictions, as you do. It's one of the reasons I like having you on the show. Will you say what you really think? And here, Kaza's saying, by the way, voted for the ANC a couple of times, voting DA this time. So I appreciate, again, people who say what they think and do what they say. I love this. Yeah.
You know, I think I think the courage of conviction is what we see with all the various people who are putting their hand up to say, I currently do not feel that there is somebody in the landscape that is offering me what I need in this country going forward. And I'm going to mobilize people around the ideas that I have, and we are going to contest. I think that if you look back, because we are talking about lessons from past heroes and the past, if you look back to 1988 and think about what South Africa was then and how hard it was and how dark it was for many people, and the fact that there were also equally as many people who were saying there is no way in hell that the NP government would be defeated and that apartheid would end in 1988.
Yes.
And yet, in 1994, we had queues and queues and queues of South Africans. One man, one vote.
Right.
And all I'm saying is the contestation of ideas, the bravery of individuals, and the mobilizing and coalescing around ideas that change not just the fortunes of the people selling those ideas, but people who buy into those ideas looks like a change for our country. And I'm simply saying that the many people who are putting up their hands, whether it is a Rise, a Patriotic Alliance, and EFF, they are contesting ideas. And if they can get people to coalesce around those ideas, then they can change the government. The consequence will be an ANC that is not in power. But if you are selling a get the ANC out, you are not going to get people to follow. That's why you have people in this comment section saying, I don't know who to vote for. even as you have a multi-party coalition where five people are saying, if you vote for my party, and between the five of us, after you have voted for us, we're going to fight for this one seat. That's what they are telling you. And that's what people are saying. I'm not sure if that's what I want to buy into. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to have to draw this to a close. There are lots of interesting comments here too. But Phumlani, you're always welcome on the show. I wish you the best of luck with your book.
Thank you.
Hold it up again so that people can see what the book looks like. This is a good one for Christmas because I love history. So Lessons from Past Heroes by Phumlani Madjozi, our guest this morning. Take a look at that and put it in the stockings this Christmas so that you can make this capitalist rich. At least try to get him to recoup the costs. Making books is not cheap, and it's not as lucrative a business as people seem to think it is. All right, Phumlani, thank you so much. I almost said Phumi Madjozi. Phumi Mashifo. Phumlani Madjozi. And Gareth Cliff, we're out for this morning. Thank you, everybody. We will see you tomorrow at 6 a.m. for a Friday special from Cape Town. Have an excellent day. Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.